and I welcome you to Pentagon Solutions today. My guests are returning to talk about something that we started to talk about the last time they were here, but we're kind of caught up because of the Pentagon budget request cycle. My guests are David Berteau and Ryan Crotty, both of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Gentlemen, it's great to see you again. Thank you for coming back. Nice to have you on.
Thank you.
When we had our last conversation, a lot of the discussion that we had revolved around the fact that although we had in hand at the time the Pentagon's new strategy, we did not have the numbers. Secretary Panetta, General Dempsey both said at that time, more will be obvious about how this will be done and where we're headed and so on when the budget numbers come out. And so we discussed that day the chance for you to come back and once we had numbers. Well, now we have numbers and you are back and I'm happy to have you talk about this. Last time we were here, David, we'll start with you. We talked about four ways to cut: personnel, operations, platforms, and overhead. Recap that conversation briefly, and we'll use that as the jumping off point now that we have numbers to see what that looks like in the Pentagon's view today.
All right. Glad to do that. I'm also really happy at your comment about George Washington. but I want to start because, of course, his likeness appears on the dollar bill. And so what the Pentagon proposed is a budget that has $520 billion of those George Washingtons in it, in the base budget, and another nearly $90 billion George Washingtons in the overseas contingency operations. So it's still a big chunk of money, even though there's been a lot of money cut out of it. What we had talked about is any enterprise that needs to reduce itself has to look at the fundamental elements of its mission that it can reduce. Mm-hmm. And the Pentagon, that's operations, and that's the ongoing day-to-day operations, readiness, support for the war, et cetera. It's personnel, both military and civilian personnel. It's the investment accounts, the procurement and the research and development. And then it's what to any company would be called overhead. Mm-hmm. But the problem is inside the federal government, as you well know, we don't have a line item for overhead.
Yes.
And therefore, you can't say, well, now we know how much of it we need to cut. So one of the difficult challenges is, even if you want to get your arms around it, what does that mean? And I think the budget only goes a short way towards beginning to answer that question.
One of the places that a lot of the conversation, Ryan, revolved around cuts in the Senate Armed Services Committee last week was Secretary Panetta and General Dempsey referred to OCO on a number of occasions. And it's one of the acronyms that people talk about as though everybody hearing it should understand what it is. Define that and talk about what you're seeing regarding OCO in this budget document.
Right. So OCO is the Overseas Contingency Operations Budget. It is outside of the base budget process. It was originally just supplemental appropriations, has now been termed the OCO budget. So this is allegedly where all war-related costs get funded from. And so it's a nice mechanism for being able to separate what the Defense Department is really spending in its general ongoing national security area and specific to war funding. Mm-hmm. It's something that we've used under different terminologies going back to buildups for all of the previous wars in the 20th century. But what we're looking at in OCO now, since we've had this long term, is the migration between OCO and base budget of certain funds. And I think that's something that lacks a little bit of clarity right now. We're looking at the operations and maintenance account has had a substantial amount of money moved back into the base budget. There's some personnel funding that's been moved into OCO. And so what we saw in the Armed Services Committee is a discussion of, is this just the old voodoo? Is this pragmatic, or is this us moving money around so that we can keep doing what we've been doing and get around these budget caps and other things like that?
As you do some analysis on what you're seeing, what's your view on that? Do you have thoughts about what it is or isn't?
I think it's a little of both.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's what we've seen with OCO is, with O&M, with operations and maintenance, makes some sense that this is money that really is going to fund the ongoing operations of the department and probably should be moving back into the base budget. That's, I think, the long-term goal is to be moving money from OCO back into the base budget where we can then get an idea of what our long-term funding strategy is. I mean, that's the problem with OCO. We don't even have a number for next year. They, mm-hmm. they tell us that they do it on a year-to-year basis, which makes some sense. They give us a $44 billion number going out, but as they release that number, they Bob Hale at the budget release categorically said that that's not a real number. That's mm-hmm. a placeholder. You know, I think we can assume from that it's more. And I know that committees in Congress are certainly concerned about the movement of MILPERS issues. I'm a little less versed on that, but I certainly I can see their concern. Mm-hmm. That's something that we should be seeing in the base budget, one would think.
Now, Dave – oh, go ahead. Sorry.
You know, Francis, for years we complained, the analysts like us complained that – the base budget had all the usual budget justification material, mm-hmm. but the supplemental appropriations or the OCO didn't have much justification material. We wanted to narrow the gap between the level of explanation and justification for the base budget and for OCO. Well, that gap's been narrowed, but it got narrowed the wrong way. We're actually getting less information about the base budget now rather than more information about the OCO, and that puts everybody at a bit of a disadvantage.
Now, there have been some lonely voices in the wilderness crying out for years that there's no need for the extra appropriation. It should all just be one bill. If the Pentagon's going to spend this money, it should spend it all under one appropriation. Why is that so hard for Congress to get past, or is there an advantage maybe to some folks in Congress for continuing this process the way it is?
There's an interesting history to this. I'm really glad you raised this up. If you go back to the end of the Vietnam War, as we created the all-volunteer force and moved away from the draft, and that's 40 years ago this year, so this is a great year to be talking about that, there was an understanding on the part of not only the Pentagon, but the Office of Management and Budget and even the Congress, that in fact we were going to fund the part of defense that was needed to be ready, but we would use supplemental appropriations to actually pay for the wars themselves. This would make it more difficult, if you will, for the executive branch to engage in a long-term conflict without congressional approval and without the support of the nation. Well, that's 40 years ago, and we've kind of moved away from that, but that mentality is still there. On the other hand, the Pentagon has a legitimate point. We put the budget together so far in advance of the actual expenditure mm-hmm. that it's hard to predict. I mean, right now, the Pentagon and across the federal government, they're beginning to look at guidance to put together the fiscal year 14 budget.
Right.
We won't start spending that budget until 2 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't see from a contingency point of view, you can't see 2 years ahead of time. So of necessity, you have to have flexibility. Therefore, you can't have it into your base budget. The challenge is don't pay for things in your OCO that ought to be in your base. And they're still playing games with that.
Now, this conversation and the term playing games, it comes in with the backdrop of the idea that the Pentagon has a deadline to hit in 2014 and then another one to hit in 2017 to be auditable for anybody to even know where all the money goes once it's given to DOD. Does that play, is that a factor in this conversation, or is that a separate issue, do you think?
I haven't thought about it as a factor in this conversation. I don't think the Pentagon has thought about it in a factor in this conversation, but I certainly believe that they wouldn't have signed up to a number like 2017 if they thought we were still going to have 100,000 troops deployed in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, they signed up for 2011 and couldn't hit that one.
They couldn't hit that one, and they signed up for 2014, and I think they'll probably miss that one. You know, we've actually missed every deadline for auditable books mm-hmm. in the federal government and in the Pentagon for 30 years. So it's going to be a big change to reverse that now and actually hit it. I've seen no evidence that we're on a track to do so, but it's a little hard to prove that we're not.
The reason I wonder about that is because I know the appropriations are the inflow. It's right. The cash in, and the audit is the cash out. But I just hear enough members of Congress at the hearings about auditability say essentially, in some cases directly, if we're not confident about where the money is going, we're more apprehensive about giving it to you in the first place.
Right. And from the Pentagon's point of view, there are some things you can track pretty well. If you buy a truck, you get a truck. If you buy a tank, you get a tank.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there's almost $200 billion a year going into services contracts where it's a little hard to measure what exactly you're getting for that. That doesn't mean you're not getting value, but it means it's hard to document it and aggregate it and demonstrate it.
You made a statement in some of the notes you sent over that I want to dig into when we come back from the break. I'm pleased to have in the studio today Dave Berteau and Ryan Crotty from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and we'll continue our conversation about the Defense Department's fiscal 2013 budget request when In Depth with Francis Rose continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Navy Rear Admiral retired Elizabeth A. Height, Vice President, U.S. Public Sector Cybersecurity Practice, HP Enterprise Services, on the Cybersecurity Combating Threats to Our Software Environment panel, sponsored by Hewlett-Packard.
Look at what the National Defense Authorization Act, signed last January, has required the Department of Defense to do, and that is require the department to implement software security assurance capabilities for both deployed software and that software that is being delivered.
Could your IT security have made you less secure? Traditional IT security defenses, firewalls, encryption, and intrusion detection systems are extremely effective, and that's the problem. They're so good that the bad guys are now training their sights on a new target: exploitable vulnerabilities in software applications. HP can help governments secure mission-critical applications by designing security in from the beginning, finding the vulnerabilities inside existing software, and fixing them quickly and cost-effectively. To learn more, visit federalnewsradio.com/HP.
Register now for AFSEA's 11th Annual Homeland Security Event, February 28th through March 1st at the Reagan Center. Focusing on vigilance during challenging times, doing more without more, this is the venue where you will hear firsthand about the critical IT issues facing our country in the fight against terrorism. This event is proudly sponsored by AT&T, Booz Allen Hamilton, CenturyLink, General Dynamics, InfoZen, NJVC, Kinetic North America, SAIC, and Verizon, and features speakers from all levels of government, military, and industry. Panelists from across the homeland security enterprise will dialogue on border security, cyberspace, immigration, disaster response, doing business with DHS, and other critical issues. Contractors and agencies will showcase the latest security products and solutions in the exposition. Register to attend or exhibit at afcea.org, keyword homeland. That's afcea.org.
The Federal IT Challenge is a series exploring the administration's aim to fundamentally change how the federal government purchases and uses IT, and a discussion around one of the biggest goals, reducing the number of federal data centers by at least 40% by 2015. During the show, Doug Bourgeois, Vice President and Federal Chief Cloud Executive for VMware, commented,
"Virtualization abstracts the operating system and the data from the device. It provides a certain amount of agility and flexibility from a technological standpoint. Using virtualization and virtual desktop infrastructure to liberate the data from the endpoint device and bring it into the private cloud, that's key. The data in particular, it provides so much more flexibility for multiple devices to be mobile and geographically disparate and still have access to that data."
To hear this show in its entirety, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword VMware.
Tom Temin here with a preview of tomorrow's Federal Drive. The Army is shrinking, yet it's bringing back wise old graybeards as it rehires annuitants and retirees. What's going on? We'll explain. Plus, it's no iTunes store, but GSA's App Store recently crossed a milestone. It's added app number 100. Those stories and more tomorrow morning, starting at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Tired of playing catch up with the news? Stay informed all the time with the Federal News Flash. The Federal News Flash is a daily email from Federal News Radio that will bring you the latest news and information about the federal government and the federal contracting world. Find out about exclusive stories and interviews only heard on Federal News Radio. Sign up for the Federal News Flash at federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, your source for federal news now.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests today on Pentagon Solutions are from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Ryan Crotty and Dave Berteau. Their latest work is called Implications of the FY13 Defense Budget. It's linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. It is short. It's only about 8 or 9 pages. And for my benefit, I see, gentlemen, this mostly pictures and graphs. So it's easy for people like me to consume. And we'll talk about some of the material that's included there. But I mentioned before the break, Dave, that in the notes that we bounced back and forth this morning. You write, cuts to the base budget are not that deep, but they're deep compared to projected growth. And I mentioned during the commercial that this, to me, reminds me of the discussions that we had about budgets in the 80s and 90s, starting, I guess, in the Reagan era, about what's a real cut and what is a slowing of growth that some people try to count as a cut. How dependent are we on that dialogue and discerning the difference in looking at what we see in the Pentagon budget?
This is really a critical point, Francis, in terms of interpreting what the Pentagon's budget will get you. You know, the Defense Department is almost unique in the federal government of actually having a fiscally disciplined long-term plan. They call it the Future Year Defense Program, an acronym FYDP, which is pronounced FITIP, of course. The transcribers always write it as FIT-UP, fit up. But nonetheless,
I didn't know there was even a pronouncer for it. That's great.
The reality is that this is a very useful tool, particularly for programs that take years to manifest themselves. You've got to invest in them, and then ultimately you get them delivered. Or for training of troops, it takes years to develop a pilot or a tank crew or something like that. And so that long-term plan that the Pentagon relies upon has been the backbone of planning. During the wars, and this was really one of the problems with OCO, is you lost the discipline of the fiscal future year program, because you could always, if you had a problem and you couldn't fund it, you could just shove it into the supplementals and pay for it that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's an oversimplification, but it was basically, we've got 10 years of not paying attention to the long-term plan.
Mm-hmm.
What these reductions did that came out of the Budget Control Act is they use as their base that projected growth. So the Pentagon was actually able, over the six-year period from fiscal year 12 to fiscal year 17, to take out $240 billion from the, quote, budget, and yet still end up with a flat base budget that keeps pace with inflation and nothing less, mm-hmm. roughly around $524 billion. It makes it look like the budget's flat, you're not really cutting. But reality, the growth that was planned for is not going to be there now. And some of that growth was normal cost growth in pay and benefits, in health care costs, et cetera. Some of it was increased cost of weapon systems.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it was buying weapon systems that essentially have been used up in the war. Because unlike the Reagan buildup, where we actually had a lot of stuff at the end of it and it was brand new and had never been used, the extra money that has flowed to defense in the last 10 years has not been used to buy new stuff that's sitting on the shelf. It's been used to fly the heck out of airplanes and steam the heck out of ships and run the heck out of ground combat vehicles. So
mm-hmm.
all the stuff we have is worn out now, and there's no place to draw from to begin to replace it. That's where the cuts are hurting the most.
What's the bottom line on the top line? You gave the number at the beginning of the show. What is that compared to both what we had in FY 2012, or what the request was for 2012, and what projections were in the past for 2013 and beyond?
Right. The $525 billion roughly that we'll be at adjusted for inflation for the next 5 years is roughly equivalent to what the defense budget was in fiscal year 2006 or 2007. So we're not going back to the trough of the 90s at the low cut. That's without, though, taking into consideration the part of OCO, the supplemental.
Yes.
The cuts there are going to be much more. So if you look at the actual investment account impact, it probably takes you back to about 2001 or 2002. It still doesn't take you back, though, to the trough of the 90s. The cuts the Pentagon has announced so far are the shortest and least steep, if you will, the shallowest cuts
mm-hmm.
of any of the major reductions since the end of World War II. This is not as big of a cut drill as we've been through before.
Some of the sexiest cuts, though, the things that make headlines and so on, are the weapon system cuts. Ryan, you've been following those. Talk about, is it fair to even parse them as winners and losers, or is that maybe oversimplifying it a little bit, do you think?
I mean, that may be an oversimplification.
I'm good at that, by the way. So.
it's important, though. You got to get a nice context. And, you know, in that way, there are certainly things that you're not going to see as much, but then again, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we are leaving major ground operations, so maybe some planned ground combat vehicles may be pushed back as we, or recapitalizations may be pushed back. And I'm not suggesting anything is a good or bad idea, but what we see is trying to make do in a lot of places with what we already have. You saw that with the Global Hawk Block 30.
Mm-hmm.
They decided that the U-2 can still do it. and that the Global Hawk was getting too expensive. You saw it with something like the Defense Weather Satellite. Well, granted, that was an appropriation decision last year, but yes. Something that the department has said they can do without. So those are the kind of the cuts. We also have the restructurings, which it's hard to know without knowing specifics on the programs about whether these are justifications or real issues. When I look at like the F-35, they have given their cutting some from 13 and then delaying a bunch out beyond the FYDP, and the explanation being that they still have a lot of testing to do. This was probably pushed too quickly, and that it'll save money in the long run, mm-hmm. At least in terms of not having to then retrofit. So that makes some sense if you're buying exactly how they're justifying it. Some of the harder things to me are, we look at some of the retirements or divestments. We're looking at like the C-27 joint cargo aircraft. Or the Global Hawk Block 30s that already have been built. These are both fairly new aircraft that, because we've decided to cut in the long run, we're probably going to get rid of the ones we already have because we don't want to have to maintain multiple systems. Mm-hmm. And that's can be somewhat of a hard sell.
Mm-hmm. We can do a whole hour on just the conversation that the Pentagon is trying the idea the Pentagon is trying to sell, that some of these programs should continue in some form so that they could be brought back if they needed to be at some point. And I don't even know that we'll have a chance to get to that today. So I'll put that on the list of things to talk about next time you're here. But when we come back, I want to talk about the fact that this is a budget request, this is the meat going into the sausage grinder, and what we actually see if Congress does actually get around to passing something could and likely will look dramatically different than what we're seeing in the document that we have. So we'll talk about that when we come back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests are David Berteau and Ryan Crotty of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and we'll continue our conversation on Pentagon solutions in a moment.
Meeting mission goals through health, brought to you by General Dynamics IT.
The Department of Health and Human Services wants to spur the creation of a new generation of software that makes electronic health records more accessible to Americans with disabilities. The Office of the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology is launching an EHR Accessibility Module Challenge. They'll award prizes of up to $60,000 for people who can create usable and accessible mobile apps for people with vision, hearing, intellectual, and other disabilities.
General Dynamics IT is meeting the challenges of a complex healthcare environment that requires far-reaching experience and full-spectrum capabilities. Government, military, and commercial health payer organizations rely on General Dynamics IT's health services, solutions, and support to tackle their toughest issues. General Dynamics IT's broad understanding of healthcare data, military health missions, fraud, waste, and abuse protection, and more ensures support and innovation tailored to your real-world needs. Today's healthcare challenges are formidable. To learn more, go to GDIT.com.
And now the Federal Living Report, brought to you by WEPA.
Has low morale led to retirements in your office? More than 70% of the federal employees who took a Federal News Radio survey say yes. The biggest morale killers, they say, are the pay freeze followed by ineffective managers and Fed bashing from Congress. Over half of the 1,700 Feds surveyed, though, say their managers could do more. They say supervisors could offer time off awards, team building events, and simple thank yous to build morale.
These are hard times for federal employees. A multi-year pay freeze, rumors of furloughs, and discussions on reducing benefits are the realities that all federal employees face. Now, more than ever, it's important to find ways to save your hard-earned money. One way is with life insurance from WEPA. WEPA offers lower rates and a premium refund policy that's returned over $58 million to its policyholders since 1996. To learn how much you can save, visit WAEPA.com. Once again, that's WAEPA.org.
Hey ladies, I'm Jill Sorensen, Caps beat reporter from Comcast Sportsnet. Want to see hockey from a woman's perspective? Then visit ScarletCaps.com to sign up for Club Scarlet for free. Members receive an exclusive newsletter, a chance to win great prizes, and invitations to members-only events, including hockey and heels. Check out scarletcaps.com for the latest blogs and info. To join, log on to scarletcaps.com now.
Activity and amyloid. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. A study indicates that people who are physically inactive and who have a higher genetic risk of developing Alzheimer's disease may have more of a protein that's associated with the development of Alzheimer's. At Washington University in St. Louis, researcher Denise Head looked at people with a form of the APOE gene, APOE4, which has been linked to greater buildup of amyloid protein in the brain.
The combination of a sedentary lifestyle and APOE4 status was associated with a higher level of amyloid deposition.
The study, which looked at people whose thinking ability was healthy, indicated more active people had less amyloid buildup. The study in Archives of Neurology was supported by the National Institutes of Health. Learn more at hhs.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
With a $1.2 trillion cut to federal spending expected over the next decade, agencies need to consider more than individual programs. They have to dramatically change the way they do business. Join AFSEA Bethesda February 24th at the Bethesda North Marriott for its annual federal budget preview as a distinguished panel of CIOs, including Richard Spires, Roger Baker, Chris Smith, and Rob Carey, discuss what technologies and initiatives will continue to drive IT spending in 2013. Register today at afseabethesda.org/febbreakfast. Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests on Pentagon Solutions today, Ryan Crotty and Dave Berteau, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and we're talking about their analysis of the fiscal 2013 Pentagon budget request. We all know that the request is exactly that. Every February we get these documents, and every September we count down until the last minute, at least for the last decade or so, waiting for a continuing resolution of some sort, and then it stretches into who knows when. I've set the over-under this year, by the way, at December 1st, and most folks have taken the over even on that late date as far as what we'll see because of it being an election year. And if you want to weigh in on that, either one of you, you're welcome to do that. Maybe we'll talk about that later on in the show. But the reality of it is what winds up going to the Pentagon is a lot different than what they send to the Hill. As you guys look at what the administration has submitted, what do you see that's likely to stick, and what do you see that's likely to look a lot different than it does today?
First of all, I think the context is a little different on the House side than it is on the Senate side. Mm-hmm. And that has partly to do with just the basic dynamics of those two chambers of the legislative branch, but also a lot to do with the election year. The Senate is actually quite comfortable using the Budget Control Act numbers, that's from the act passed last August, as the basis for their FY13 allocations, the 302B allocations, so-called, from the Budget Reform Act, to the subcommittees of the Appropriations Committee. Mm-hmm. The House is going to actually produce a new budget document, if you will. So in a way, they're walking away from that painfully crafted debt ceiling relief deal we call the Budget Control Act from just last August, mm-hmm. and are going to create new numbers. That's going to give the House more opportunity to change the way the defense budget looks because they'll have maneuvering room inside their own budget allocation. The Senate won't have the same deal. They're going to have to live with the same number, which makes for less puts and takes, if mm-hmm. you will, inside that. And the House has to do that, Francis, because they're all running for reelection. On the Senate side, only one-third are running for reelection. As you know, about 7 or 8 of those has decided not to run for reelection, so you've got a number of seats. And really only about 12 competitive seats up for grabs on the Senate side. 10 of them are currently Democrats, 2 are Republicans. So the stakes are a little different, if you will. Mm-hmm. Plus, the House Republicans are much more vulnerable to a challenge from their right.
Yeah.
So they have to create a case, if you will, through their legislation. So given all that, the Pentagon's budget then, I think that one thing that's likely to stick is the cuts in Army personnel and Marine Corps personnel. Mm. Both the Army Chief of Staff and the Marine Corps Commandant, as well as the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, have all signed up to and agree with that. In fact, in some cases, they've said, we actually might need to go a little faster and a little further. Mm-hmm. So I don't think the Congress will add that back. I think they're likely to sustain most of the cuts in operation and maintenance because it actually is a cut in the overseas contingency operations and a plus up in the base budget. That will look fine as well. Where the cuts are likely to come under threat is the individual line items, the program terminations, the program stretch-outs in the procurement account, if you will, and that's where Congress will probably play a stronger role this year.
It's interesting to me to watch this debate already starting to play out, and Chairman McKeon in particular has been outspoken since the very beginning, back when Secretary Gates first started talking about this process. This is my thought, not anybody else's, but almost to the point of zealotry, that just the concept of cutting anything top line, regardless of how it was restructured underneath, was just not acceptable. The scenario that you're painting creates an interesting conference committee process, I think, in trying to reconcile two dramatically different pieces of legislation. What's the potential complication there just on a process level in Congress?
Well, and that process level is exacerbated by the fact that it is an election year, so they're going to take a particularly long summer break. It has two conventions built into it,
mm-hmm.
One of which in Tampa at the height of hurricane season is fraught
with the
potential
of that.
For delay. Or deferral, if you will. I don't quite know who did the weather forecast for that for the Republicans, but they're going there anyway. And I think that the reality is that at the front end, they'll probably stick to their schedule for the authorizers and probably for the appropriators. At the back end, in terms of conference and a final bill, more likely we'll certainly not only see the continuing resolution that you speculated on. I'm not sure that I would go under on your December 1st, actually. But that really depends on who wins on November 6th.
Mm-hmm.
If the president's reelected and if there's a close enough margin in the Senate that is still in play, if you will, that probably moves forward the date of agreement. If, in fact, the Republicans win the White House, then there's no motivation for the Republicans in Congress to cut any deal. They can just take a CR through the 113th Congress arising and then figure out what they're going to do at that point.
And I'm just envisioning some of the nightmare scenarios now as you're speaking about that we've heard in the last couple of years where one or two seats are contested and recount. Oh, what a potential nightmare.
Well, we all remember this. Hanging chads, and, you know, they could be hanging everywhere by the time we're finished here.
Lord have mercy. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about the boogeyman that has been surrounding this entire conversation. And I want to, Ryan, especially get you in on the sequestration conversation when we come back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is Pentagon Solutions. My guest today from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Dave Berteau and Ryan Crotty, and we'll continue our conversation in just a moment.
If you are facing advanced illness or the end of life of a loved one, peace of mind is in short supply. Fortunately, pain-free comfort care is available from the Washington Home and Community Hospices, a not-for-profit organization with a holistic team of doctors, nurses, caregivers, social workers, chaplains, and volunteers. The team comes to you in your home or wherever you call home in D.C., Montgomery, or Prince George's County. For your peace of mind, call them day or night for a complimentary consultation at 866-234-7222.
Dude, check out my new Pioneer DEH44 car stereo with built-in HD radio technology and new HD2 HD3 channels.
HD2 HD3 channels?
Get with it, man. HD2 HD3 channels are all these new free digital radio channels.
How do I listen to them?
With the new Pioneer DEH44 HD radio receiver. It's only $120 at Walmart.
Walmart? That's cool.
Yeah, just go to HDradio.com and check out the station guide. They're adding new channels all the time.
Learn about HD radio technology at HDradio.com. More radio, more value.
What is causing low morale at your agency, and what can managers do to fix it? Check out our special report, Managing Morale, Fixing the Problems Plaguing Your Federal Office, online at federalnewsradio.com. See the results of our exclusive survey on federal morale and hear what Congress expects of feds during these tough budget times. OPM Director John Barry tells us how he motivates employees, plus tips from leadership experts. Find it all at federalnewsradio.com. Search term morale.
The Department of Defense faces some big changes in the coming years. I'm Federal News Radio's DoD reporter, Jared Serbin. We help you track those changes every Wednesday afternoon from 2 to 3 with On DoD. Each week, we'll talk one-on-one with defense experts and senior managers about the policies, programs, and innovations that affect warfighters and how the military will continue to meet its mission. That's On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Ryan Crotty and Dave Berteau of the Center for Strategic and International Studies analyzing the fiscal 2013 DoD budget request and discussing it with me on Pentagon Solutions today. And the word that has surrounded any discussion of Pentagon finances more than any other over the past year or so has been the word sequestration. It came up about 798,000 times between the House Armed Services Committee and Senate Armed Services Committee last week with Secretary Panetta and General Dempsey. And it has permeated every conversation about the defense budget for some period of time now. Ryan, as you look at what is possible and what is likely and what could or couldn't happen if we get to that point, what do you see? What are some themes that you're seeing before we get into some more specifics?
Right. So I think one piece is, as background that we spoke about last time we were on the show, is that when you look at the Budget Control Act, we're seeing that it is written in a way that would seem to suggest that this sequestration cut would happen at the account level, at shipbuilding or at Army aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And so that level of cuts makes it a lot easier for DoD to digest a cut because you can move things around a little more. There's a little more flexibility, even though it would still be very difficult and certainly not advisable. It would be a little easier. And now we are seeing some indications that OMB has been giving guidance that they're going to be applying sequestration in the classic program, project, or activity, which does the old, as Panetta would say, the you can't buy 75% of a ship. Well, that's
right.
That's where this comes in, is it directs it at each program.
Mm-hmm. What's the implication there? What's the difference?
Yeah, the difference is that it is a lot harder. It over-dramatizes the effects. It allows Secretary Panetta to say things like, instead of we're going to not buy one LCS, it is, well, we are planning to buy this aircraft carrier, and guess what? We don't have the money for it because we have lost this, you know, this 15% or, mm-hmm. or whatever it may be at the end of the program.
Yeah.
So it really over-dramatizes the effects.
And it's not like buying a Mustang where you can just get the V6 instead of the 302, right?
Sadly, no.
Yeah, I know.
Well, actually, we are doing some of that, but you know.
Well, and that's an interesting concept, actually. I wasn't intending to go there, but that's a conversation that I think is worth having in the context of sequestration is – there are we talked about lone voices crying out in the wilderness. There are some folks that are talking about that concept of the things that we're buying, we don't necessarily need all the capability that we're buying. Is that fair? Is that a fair way to look at it? Is there a possibility that we could get the V6 instead of the 302 in some of these cases? And would there be significant savings if we did at the expense of the operations that would be compromised?
It's really a very difficult dynamic to analyze completely, and probably warrants another show. But ultimately, gets back to the question of how do you determine the requirements? How
mm-hmm.
do you set the performance standards of a weapon system or the performance standards of a mission or a capability? That requirements process has become sacred to where the question of cost can't be allowed to interfere with it. We're going to give the military what they need, at least in terms of setting the requirements, even if we can't achieve them. Ultimately, when it comes time to delivering, we compromise based on reality. Wouldn't it be useful if actually we did that evaluation based on potential reality mm-hmm. at the front end instead of waking at the back end after you've wasted billions of dollars to get there?
I guess I'm thinking of the point that some of the weapon systems doves make, which is how many times do you need to blow up the target and how many pieces of equipment do you need to blow it up the one time that you really need to do it right?
Right, and yet at the same time, you look, for instance, where there's talk now about reducing the total number of nuclear weapons, and that could include reducing the number of strategic ballistic missile submarines that are deployed. The fewer you have, the more important it becomes that they be very stealthy and very fast. Mm-hmm. And so actually, you get the reverse. Mm. As your quantity goes down, your quality actually has to go up in order to be able to meet your mission and achieve your objectives.
I had an interesting conversation maybe 2 years or so ago with General Dick Myers, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and we were talking about the 85% solution was the concept, that the way he framed that concept versus every bell and whistle. And there is a reluctance, I think, on the part of many in the civilian and the uniform side to accept the 85% solution. And yet, and again, maybe oversimplifying it, but that 15% might make the difference between making some of these numbers and not making some of these numbers.
It very well could. You have to remember, we're not actually buying for today.
Uh-huh.
The stuff we're buying today will be what the soldiers and sailors and airmen and marines are using in 2035.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's 85% today might be 15% then. And so that's what the counter argument of that is. My own view is we can go a long way towards doing a better job of doing cost engineering trade-offs as part of the requirements process and save a ton of money. There's a lot more money to be saved in defense than just this budget, but not the way we're going at it now.
And a lot of this, based on some of the charts that you have here, a lot of this is money, is people.
Right.
You have these charts are terrific, and we have them linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. But you've got two here that are both titled Share of Budget versus Share of Cuts, and you've got one that's divided by portfolio and one that's divided by service. And they're very telling. And the one about that's divided by portfolio, I think, is the most interesting, because I can't tell you how many programs I've done over the past couple of years about the critical need for development of the acquisition workforce. And yet we see here, according to this chart, that you developed these, right, Ryan?
Yes.
Nice work. 18% of the budget goes to procurement, and 38% of the cuts come from the procurement budget. It's hard to see a sustainment there when vendor after vendor after vendor and the Pentagon official after official after official say we have to shore this workforce up. We need more of them. They need to be better trained. They need to be better experienced. So we have to figure out a way to retain the people that were developed, on and on and on and on.
Right. Well, I think what you're seeing, and this is where the rubber meets the road, is that there are some things that are easier to do in the short term, and this is a short-term budget. They are trying to get under the caps for 2013, and as much as you might want to take down military personnel as they are planning, you're trying to, you know, you end up reducing OCO a little bit. Procurement and RDT&E, the investment accounts, are the easiest way to cut in the short term.
RDT&E means what?
Research, design, test, and evaluation.
Excellent.
And that is the easy places to do it. That's mm-hmm. that's the short answer, is that they've told us that that procurement is going to take more like 30% of the cuts as opposed to the almost 40% we see now. But it's because it's what you can do next year.
And there's less resistance there from the Buck McKeons of the world, because that's not sexy to really talk about cuts there. Is that fair to say, Dave?
That's right. In fact, if you look at the nature of rebuilding the acquisition workforce, of course, you have to do it in the context of the federal civilian career workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that they've had no friends in the Congress, effective friends in the Congress, for the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Try to recruit today under the grounds of we're going to freeze your pay forever, we're going to make you contribute more for retirement costs, and we may end up furloughing you next year under sequestration. I don't think you're going to get a lot of good positive response.
That's Dave Berteaux of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and his colleague Ryan Crotty, also in the studio with me for Pentagon Solutions today on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. We'll wrap up with our conversation with the effect that this might all have on the defense industrial landscape when In Depth with Francis Rose continues on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Listen to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, every Friday morning at 11, brought to you by the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth. Fed Talk features live interviews with guests from the federal community sharing their insights on issues that affect you.
Call in or email questions or comments to fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. FedTalk is sponsored by GEICO. This week on FedTalk, host Bill Bransford will be joined by the Federal Managers Association to learn about its upcoming annual conference and training.
What is the value of a central provider like GSA and its federal acquisition service? How is FAS managing in an era of fiscal constraint? Join host Michael Keegan as he explores these questions and much more with Stephen Kempf, Commissioner, GSA's Federal Acquisition Service, next week on the Business of Government Hour.
Register now for AFSEA's 11th Annual Homeland Security Event, February 28th through March 1st at the Reagan Center. Focusing on vigilance during challenging times, doing more without more, this is the venue where you will hear firsthand about the critical IT issues facing our country in the fight against terrorism. This event is proudly sponsored by AT&T, Booz Allen Hamilton, CenturyLink, General Dynamics, InfoZen, NJVC, Kinetic North America, SAIC, and Verizon, and features speakers from all levels of government, military, and industry. Panelists from across the Homeland Security enterprise will dialogue on border security, cyberspace, immigration, disaster response, doing business with DHS, and other critical issues. Contractors and agencies will showcase the latest security products and solutions in the exposition. Register to attend or exhibit at afcea.org, keyword homeland. That's afcea.org.
Hi, welcome to Best Buy. Can I help you?
Yeah, I've been learning about HD radio technology at hdradio.com, and I'd like to see what kind of HD radio receivers are available.
Easy answer. Here at Best Buy, we sell all kinds of HD radio receivers. Home, portables, car, boomboxes with iPod docking.
Cool. Are they expensive?
Nope. This Insignia portable HD radio player is only $49.99, and there's no subscription to listen to HD radio stations.
Sweet. Let's get started.
Learn about HD radio technology at hdradio.com. More radio, more value.
Attention federal managers. The Federal Managers Association invites all federal managers, supervisors, and executives to its National Management Training Seminar, Federal Managers Doing More with Less, on Tuesday, March 13th. Federal managers will gather in Arlington, Virginia for practical presentations, including 7 quick fixes for enhancing performance, improving employee productivity and well-being, and decisively addressing conduct-related issues. For more details, visit fedmanagers.org. That's fedmanagers.org.
Back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My guests are Dave Berteau and Ryan Crotty of the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And our conversation revolves around their work on analyzing the fiscal 2013 budget request for the Department of Defense. I find the convergence of the defense industrial base, the Pentagon, and the broader business world, Wall Street, if you will, a pretty fascinating convergence that I don't think gets a lot of play. When you gentlemen look at that confluence, what do you see as far as where we are today and what effect this budget might have on the landscape overall of the defense industry?
We're one of the few think tanks around that actually looks at that convergence, Francis, and we find it fascinating. What we see in the defense budget is drawdowns, and as Ryan talked about in the previous segment, 38% of the cuts are in procurement. Another 7% are in research and development. So almost half of the cuts, if you will, are in the investment accounts of procurement and research and development. And that's where the major hardware defense industry lives, if you will. So it's big impact on them. And yet, you know, they're probably generally okay because not a lot of program terminations, more stretch outs, and in the long run, their business base looks pretty stable because of those flat budgets that we talked about.
Ryan, as you look at some of the things that, especially in R&D, and the impact that that might have on the landscape, what do you see there? What impact is could any of this potentially have when it comes to R&D?
Well, we certainly see that R&D has taken less of the degree of cuts than they make up of the budget, which is a positive sign that the commitment to S&T and R&D is real. But Dave and I were just speaking earlier about the fact that a lot of the basic research is becoming more problematic, that it's no longer being done in industry. It's being done in federally funded research institutions and universities and outside of the prime contractors. And whether this creates a problem in the nexus between the basic research and the development of these important products.
Go ahead, Dave.
Two things that I worry about, though, with the industry, both from the research and development side and from the procurement side. Number one, there's a pretty strong squeeze still from the Pentagon on reducing profits, and it's hard to tell the difference between cutting cost and cutting profit because, of course, for many of these contracts, cost is the basis for profit. The Pentagon says we're not trying to cut profit, we're just trying to improve performance, but it's hard sometimes to see the net effect being different. The thing that I more worry about, though, is the political game that says contractors are evil, contractors are bad. You even saw this in some of the questions last week of Secretary Panetta on the Senate and the House side, if you will. One congressman, one senator actually said, why can't you just get rid of the contractors and keep the troops? Well, the fact of the matter is, first of all, the troops are way more expensive than the contractors in damn near every case. Second is, that's not what you want your troops to be doing.
Yeah.
You want your troops to be preparing to fight and win a war, not actually doing the things contractors do. But the idea somehow that contractors are bad, I think, is a political mentality that we've got to get past.
Jack Gansler, who was Undersecretary of ATL in a Democratic administration that you would assume would be more predisposed toward being favorable to insourcing and less favorable toward working with contractors, calls it the global war on contractors.
I wouldn't go quite that far, but I think there's a mentality that says contractors are bad.
Mm-hmm.
And again, most of the time, all they're doing is what the government has contracted for them to do. So if there's a problem here, a lot of times it's the government that didn't write the contract properly.
Well, I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with both industry and DOD people about requirements and the situation that the agency gets into. And it's not fair to beat up on the Pentagon. It's every federal agency has with requirements, especially in the services contracts that we talked about that are even more difficult to manage and keep a handle on.
Absolutely, especially there. And there, change is going to have to come bottom up because those contracts are at the local level or the activity level rather than top down like a major weapon system.